Welcome back to SyndicatedNews.net. Today we're having the maestro, the pianist, Byron Janis. Mr. Janis is here with us, and we're not going to take up a lot of his time because he's very busy and he has much to do, so we're going to talk about the important things that he needs to let the world know. So, Mr. Janis, are you with us?
I'm with you.
Wonderful. Welcome to Syndicated News.
Thank you.
Tell me, when was it that you first understood what it means to overcome adversity?
I was very young. I was 11 years old. And I put my hand through a glass door and removed it quickly and severely cut my little finger on my left hand. It was down to the bone, as a matter of fact. And I came to the hospital immediately. They operated on it, and a nerve was cut. And a tendon was cut, and one of the joints ended up not bending. As a result of that, that finger has been totally numb until today. So I played with 9.5 fingers.
Wow.
Yes, that was a serious, very serious problem.
When were you diagnosed with arthritis?
That was in 1973. I had a little patch on my very painful patch on my fourth finger, and it was diagnosed as psoriatic arthritis, which is a form of arthritis that is accompanied by psoriasis, which is that skin problem, except I have very little psoriasis. So that got a very difficult time diagnosing it at first, but then it was obvious that I did. And when I asked him what was psoriatic arthritis, he said, "No, it doesn't get any better." Well, that was not too pleasant for me to hear, obviously. So it got progressively worse. I tried every kind of medication, like acupuncture, hypnosis, all kinds of alternate medicines. Again, they said, "Well, you won't be able to play, I'm afraid." And I heard that story before, and I said, "Oh, yes, I will." So I was having these cortisone injections, all kinds of things. But you know what I like to tell people is that when you have a passion for something, a real passion, and you have a talent for it, and you have a perseverance, you can do amazing things. And there's almost nothing that's impossible. And you know, I've written a book. It's called Chopin and Beyond, My Extraordinary Life in Music and the Paranormal. Now, the paranormal is a word I don't like because it indicates something that's abnormal. In fact, what the paranormal is very simply the unknown normal. Everything that happens in this universe is normal. We don't think it is until we get a scientific approval of it. But they're pretty far behind the things that are happening. I mean, you saw just lately this story about arsenic being one of the components of life, a sixth component of life. They found this on a lake bed in California that was living on arsenic. Now, if you saw that some years ago, they'd say you're absolutely mad, rather than that. And that's what one has to struggle against when you talk about this unknown normal, because people, they're frightened of it. Such a shame, because not only does it enrich your life, all these experiences can happen to anybody who believes and who has an open mind. That is a secret, really, an open mind. And in my book is really about three things. It's about my musical career, it's about my battle with arthritis, and it's about the unknown normal. They all, which is threaded through my life, and which was a very important factor in my realizing that there was much more than met the eye, and that there were other things which some people can't accept. But I was going to write this book 10 years ago, and then I decided no, I wasn't ready to talk about that area of life. And then I said, yes, I am ready to talk about it. And, you know, whatever, let the chips fall where they may. Those people who think I'm mad, let them think so. That's fine. there's so much evidence. I mean, it's so silly to think that way, really, because Einstein said, you know, we understand about 2% of how the universe functions.
I was reading the preface that your wife wrote for the book, and she talks about how coincidence and things just blossoming by accident are truly meant to be and not accidental at all.
That's very often true. That's called sort of synchronicity. It was Carl Jung, the great philosopher, who coined that word. And the synchronicity happens to people all the time, but they sort of ignore it. And something happens in your life that's meaningful, and you say, how strange that this happened, two things coming together at the same time, two events, whatever. And then you realize later why it happened when it did. There was a reason for it. And it's really quite interesting to remember those things and not to take them for granted. Because it happened to everybody.
I remember about 3 hours ago, someone called to say they were canceling the 2 o'clock. And here I was ready to call your publicist.
Yes.
And the phone rings. She answers. And she says, oh, I was just writing to you. How about 2 o'clock?
Yeah.
And my hair stood on end. I said, isn't that something? That slot opened up. And that's the time he wants to talk. Some of my best interviews happen that way. There's no planning. They just fall right on the desk like a feather.
That's so true, what you're saying. And these stories are, it's happened so often, and I don't know why. They just want to forget about it. You know, when I talk to some people sometimes about a dinner partner, I speak about something a little bit unusual to them just to see what their reaction will be. And they sort of are interested. And finally, after a while, they say, you know, I never told anybody this.
Yes!
And then out comes the most extraordinary story that is even beyond what I've experienced.
And they're afraid to tell it because they think they're going to be laughed at.
They think they're going to be laughed at. They're going to be called mad.
Mm-hmm.
One of the purposes of my writing is, there were several, but one of them was really to give that message of, what can I say, of hope. I think that's what it is, that almost nothing is impossible. And what helped me a lot during very, very difficult periods was the knowledge that there's so much more. You know, when I was very young, I want more than music. And I had no idea what I was talking about because music was my world, everything to me. So I said, what am I talking about? And then
What did you want? What more did you want?
I thought it was something humanitarian.
Yes.
Level, something that affects all people everywhere. Music does a lot of that, but I wanted something more than that. I wanted to be involved in some kind of really big humanitarian situation. And of course, what has happened is that I am now, because, you know, the arthritis, I've written this book. I have a DVD of a television documentary, which is called The Byron Janis Story.
We have that on our front page. We have the cover of the DVD and the cover of the book, both.
And then there will be a recording, which was done surreptitiously in Russia, Soviet Union in 1960, which I knew nothing about, which will be coming out also. But I want to give 25% of all those things to the Arthritis Foundation.
I wanted to ask you, how long have you been working with the Arthritis Foundation now?
Since about 1985. I've been what they call an artistic ambassador. I did a lot of dinners and benefits for them and so forth. But recently, the difference here is that this is something of mine that I am making, let's say, royalties out of, but I want to give part of myself, my royalties to them, you know?
That's lovely.
Because I've learned a lot from them about many things. And I know that they are behind this whole thing very strongly, obviously because they need money, understandably. And so for research, you know something, when they find a cure, which in my opinion is not too long away, I hope, I don't know, next 10 years perhaps, they will find a cure for cancer because they are both autoimmune diseases.
Correct.
Right?
Yes.
And once you have why this occurs, I don't know whether you have had this experience, but everybody, so many people have cancer today. It's unreal, terrible. And, of course, arthritis is the number one disabling disease in the country. Some 50, 60 million people have it. It doesn't kill you, but, boy, it can. You can be, how can I say that? Your life can end in another way. It's very difficult.
I was watching a bit of the documentary, and I was watching as you walked past all of the different types of braces that you've had to wear.
Yes.
That was quite remarkable.
Well, yes. You know, I had 5 operations on my hands while I was playing.
That is amazing. On both hands? On both hands?
Both hands. Wrists also. Uh-huh. Wrists. And the first surgeon, who should be nameless, shortened my left thumb. So it was about 3/8 of an inch shorter than it should be. And that is not a joke. So I got over all kinds of things that I'll never get over. And I went into a severe depression and really bad one. And I thought, well, that's it. And then my wife, Maria, whose father happens to be Gary Cooper, came to me and said, Barn, I'd like you to write some kind of a theme for my father's documentary that's being done on him. And I was just, I hadn't touched the piano in a year. And I said, oh, I can't do that. And she said, you can, you will. And so finally I did. I wrote this theme, and she came in the room crying and said, why are you crying? She said, well, you've captured my father. It was like he was walking into the room. Well, that, of course, thrilled me. And then when I had... when I had comments from the head of Warner Chapel in New York, he heard the song, he heard it, and others that I had written when I was younger. He said, you know, you can write. And anyway, that started my whole thing about my writing musicals, which... and so forth and so on. But that got me out of depression. I knew I had another way to go.
Was that part of the new collaboration?
With the foundation?
Because it seems like it started a whole new career.
Yes, it did. Crossovers.
Crossovers, exactly.
But I am. I've written a lot of popular songs. I've written the musicals, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, which takes time, but I think we're going to have something done and we'll have it. Really getting rid of some of the lyricists, et cetera, et cetera. But I think something's going to happen with that in the next 2 years.
Mr. Janice, when you do that, I hope you'll come back to syndicatednews.net and play it for us. We'd love to feature it.
I'd be delighted to.
We will be promoting it all over the place. Now, what plans do you have? What other events do you have for this year, for 2011?
Well, I have a lot of performances of different kinds. One of them is where I do a talk on Chopin and play sort of words and music. The people are very interested to learn about the man, but they don't know anything about him. And I do that in various cities. I've done that. Then I'm also giving master classes, which I think are very important because I've had such great teachers in my life, and I want to pass that on. So that's part of what I'm doing. There are many things that I just don't want to talk about yet, but they are burbling, so to speak. And, you know, I can still play. That's the point.
But the next time we talk, you can tell me about these little secrets, can't you, in the future?
Yes, of course. Because I just don't want to talk about people. But there's only one thing, if I may say, that has disturbed me for quite a while. And that is...
Tell me.
That one of, I think it's even in the Groves Dictionary of Musicians or whatever.
Tell me.
Saying that I stopped my career. I stopped playing at about, 20-some in 1980 or something like that, or even before 1980. And nothing could be further from the truth. The whole point of my story is that I did not stop playing. I think in those 12 years where I never talked about the fact that I had arthritis, there were 2 years, I would say, where I was off the stage because of that 1 year of depression I told you about. The other year, by the way, arthritis in itself is a depressive disease. But more than that, I think there were things that happened with my hands and I needed to take a little time. But no more than that. And they are all saying that I stopped playing. It's not true. I think maybe the reason was I didn't play in New York.
Mr. Janice, my recommendation, and forgive my being so presumptuous,
please.
But who knows your life better than you do? You are allowed to address all those publications and set the record straight. You could go right to Wikipedia and you can go right to the journals and say, by the way, I didn't stop playing. You can correct that.
I know, I really should.
You can. It doesn't cost you a thing. You can correct that.
But, you know,
that's an error. They've made a mistake, and you can correct it.
A mistake, and I played all over in the States and all over Europe. I stayed out of New York for a good 8 years or so. And so that's what made them think. I stayed out of New York because I knew I wanted to really be at my best, you know? And I would have stopped this whole thing had my standards not been met. But I met standards. Or there would be a couple of concerts that I said, uh-oh, you know, if this keeps going, you've got to stop. But they didn't keep going. There would be one concert that would be better than even before. So it was kind of strange, you know? But,
well, the wonderful assistant that helped coordinate and the publicist that helped coordinate this interview itself, have them prepare a letter, sign it, have it notarized, and issue it to all these publications everywhere. Send it everywhere.
That's a very good point. Thank you for that. I will do it. I've been lax about doing something like that.
And coming from you, it becomes part of your biographical provenance.
Yes, yes.
Absolutely. Correct that point, because it's not true. You didn't stop playing. Let the world know.
That's the whole point of the story. I didn't stop.
Exactly.
Because I found ways of managing, you know, and if I, as I say, and keeping my standards. And if you, those reviews that I had at that time, most of them they had no idea I had anything wrong with me.
Right, and simply because you weren't playing in New York, they assume, oh, if you're not in New York, you're not playing. That's ridiculous.
You're absolutely right. Thank you for that. That's a good point. I will do that.
So anyone who listens to this interview, remember that he was simply not playing in New York. It wasn't that he wasn't playing. And New Yorkers should not be so centric that they think, well, if you're not playing in New York, you're not playing. That's ridiculous.
But big world out there.
Yeah, but for biography purposes, this is very important. You should write a letter, notarize it, and have your assistants send it everywhere.
Mm-hmm. I will. I'm going to do that.
Absolutely.
Thank you. I will tell the people who help me how that you told me this and what good advice it is.
It's absolutely necessary. And in fact, the next time you have the next release of the Byron Janis story, include the fact that, by the way, it's coming from Mr. Janis himself, and have the statement from your attorneys that states he's perfectly fine, and simply because he didn't play in New York during that epoch does not mean he wasn't playing. He simply wasn't on the East Coast. That's all.
Well, the story on the documentary, I think, sort of insinuates that, you know?
Yes, absolutely.
But it does say that, but other things, and so does my book, of course, say that.
Mm-hmm.
That's the whole point of this, the impossible becoming possible, and that's mind over matter, and, you know, it's been a very strong part of my life, this normal unknown.
The normal unknown and the many gaps of ignorance that we have to fill.
Exactly.
Simply because we don't know something doesn't mean it does not exist.
Hear, hear. Because look at every day, there's something that we hadn't known, right?
And we thought that wasn't the case.
Possible. There's so many things out there. People who are paralyzed can use their eyes on the machine to spell out words. It's incredible. But people never would have thought that was a possibility.
And I remember when I was at WHAM Radio in Rochester, New York, doing my internship in the newsroom, I remember that we could reach 10, 15, 20,000 people. Oh, and we were jumping up and down. We thought that was marvelous. And on the Internet, that's what we reach in 20 minutes.
Exactly.
Plus, radio doesn't go away on the Internet. This interview, for instance, will be available to everyone and anyone on a 24-hour-a-day basis, any given time of the day from any part of the world. They will be listening to this interview.
That's wonderful. I'm very glad you asked me to be on.
And what music would you like us to add to your interview? Which of your pieces? Because your office is preparing them now.
Well, yes. I thought there was probably a waltz of Chopin. Actually, it's
Which one?
It's the G-flat posthumous waltz that I discovered.
You want to share that story with us? That is a wonderful story.
Yeah, that's the way one of my relationships with Chopin became very, very, very strong. And that was one of the things that happened. He loved Chopin. He heard me play in Paris. He invited me, Maria, out to his chateau for lunch.
The Viscount.
Yes. He's now a count.
Yeah. Oh.
His son died, you see.
Oh, my.
So, yeah, anyway, and it's an interesting story. They are descendants of officer who fought with Lafayette, and any officer who fought with Lafayette has the privilege of having joint citizenship between U.S. and French citizenship.
I love the way your wife wrote that piece where she says we were driving along and there appeared the home, and she says it appeared like a bouquet, and I thought, what a lovely way to say that.
Well, it's beautiful. And anyway, very totally by accident, the trunk marked old clothes we were looking at, and there were these manuscripts. Paul thought they were something scribbled by his grandma.
Exactly.
And I said, no, these are Chopin, and there were differences. I went to Panama. And quickly, the next story was that 6 years later, I was at Yale giving a master class, and they showed me the music that they had, and why did I point? This is the whole point of this guy. I just pointed this one. I said, what's that? Up on the shelf in the archive room. And I said, oh, let's see. There were about four or five professors in the room. So one of them went up and, oh, it's Mark Chopin. So I was, oh, can I see it? Of course. So I was sitting down, fortunately, and I opened this folder.
Tell me.
There were the same two waltzes in earlier versions, written 1 year earlier.
Oh.
Now, Yale, it was a front page story on the New York Times originally. Walter Cronkite had it. It was all over the place. And Yale never said, hey, we've got two more of these waltzes, earlier versions. Not a word. They were not cataloged. And somehow it slipped through the crack. You know, these things happen. But that I happened to be the one to find them was kind of thrilling for me. And sort of made me think. The chapters of that.
I think that's a mystery of nature, don't you?
Sure. Absolutely.
That it would have been you who found it?
Yes, it's uncanny, isn't it?
That's lovely. And in the book, I love the way your wife wrote about the differences in the ones that you found and the ones at Yale.
Mm-hmm. Yes, well, they were quite different, which showed so well the composer's creative changes as he went along. You know, we always feel that something is written down and that's it. And you know, if the composer could, I'm sure he would keep on changing things just like we do. It's kind of...
When I was a child, I would hear Chopin, and I didn't know who it was, but I would sit there and cry and bawl my eyes out. And my grandmother would ask me, why are you crying? And I said, I don't know why. He breaks my heart.
Yes.
And to this day, I hear Chopin, and it makes my eyes water. I have to leave the room because I lose my composure. It so touches me. Well, some of his pieces so touch me.
Yeah, some of them are so, so touching. The Polish word żal, which is what he said, yes, his music was full of żal, which meant bittersweet melancholy.
Yes, melancholy.
And if he was like that, and that's Slavic and Polish, and besides that, he was very much like that. And he suffered a lot since he was 8 to 21, he got tuberculosis, and the rest of his life, he was coughing and blood and all that stuff. So half his life was that. And when I was very young, I said to my mother, I want to read about Chopin. Not only his music, I wanted to understand this man. You know what you're saying about crying? I would read his book about it and I'd start crying because something about him was so touching and so beautiful.
I think he wrote the pain he was experiencing. I think that's what I felt when I heard his pieces.
Yes, yes.
It hurt me, and I was thinking he has to either be hurt emotionally or physically to write this way.
Yes, you're right. I believe that too.
And that's what I felt when I heard him. And I used to say that. Me rompe el corazón. He's breaking my heart. That's what I felt. Yeah.
Well, he did. You know, he said, I can't remember the exact quote, but he said, Beethoven and Mozart strove for higher goals than I do. But he said, my desire was only to touch the human soul.
He always has, and he always will.
He always will. Yes.
And I've heard your music. So do you. So do you.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you.
I just go around YouTube looking for things that are available that you've done, and I find them from time to time, and so do you. You touch a person's coro. You touch the heart, absolutely.
Well, I think that's the most important is to play. And as Chopin said, play with all your soul. All your soul.
How you play with 9 fingers, I don't know.
And joints that don't bend, now that I think about, I play very, I don't play recitals anymore. I think to myself, how did I do that? It's like when you're doing it, you're in another place entirely. And I was in that other place all those years.
Yeah. And I was reading where Mrs. Janice said, you never know moment to moment what's going to be happening in our lives because we're sitting with a maestro, with a master musician. You never know what's going to happen next.
Well, that's probably true of artists, but of me, with me, you know, it was a daily...
That's what she wrote.
Yes.
That's what she wrote. It was lovely. I didn't know that she wrote that well. It was beautifully written.
She writes very well. She did a book on her father, as a matter of fact, which is so well written. And she writes very well. Yeah.
I didn't read that. I read what she wrote about you. I didn't read what she wrote about her father, but my curiosity is piquing.
Perhaps we can send you one.
No, that's okay. That's okay. When I go to and buy it through your website and have the experience, that will do it for me.
All right.
Okay. And I recommend to everyone, we haven't mentioned it, we have to mention it now, the website, www.byronjanice, and I'm going to spell it out for you, www.byronjanice.com, and you can buy the DVD there, you can purchase music there, you can buy the book there, and everything Mr. Janice has to offer is right on his website. Is that correct?
Yes, you can buy anything, or Amazon.
Yes, and we have all of those pieces linked, the book, the DVD, and music.
Thank you very much, yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your kindness. We are so grateful. And thank your assistant and Mrs. Janice for writing such a beautiful preface.
I will tell her that. Thank you. She will be very happy that you feel that.
Thank you so much. And with that, we end this interview, and lovely music played by Mr. Janice will continue. I'm not even going to announce which piece because I don't know as of yet. It will be a lovely surprise to even me.
Thank you so much.